scientific research and discovery in respect, as we should, we must also be alert to the equal and opposite danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific, technological elite.
We've signed a climate convention on the importance of economic instruments and free markets. We're included in this mammoth Agenda 21 document and the Rio Declaration. Let me be clear on one fundamental point. The United States fully intends to be the world's preeminent leader in protecting the global environment.
Coming up, Technocracy News. And welcome to Technocracy News and Trends. Patrick Wood here, Editor-in-Chief, and today is the 14th of November, 2019, and we've got some interesting stories today to bring to you. The first one has to do with data. Data is always a hot topic in the technocracy world because, well, you just can never get enough data. You always have to have more. It doesn't matter how granular you get with the data, there's always another level, deeper and more intense, that you can drill into. Well, the title of this first article is Data, Data Everywhere, but not one ounce of wisdom. And you can see where I'm going with this. I wrote at the top of this article, data is the lifeblood of technocracy. It fills the sails of artificial intelligence. It's the new oil of the 21st century. It is the gusher of the Internet of Things. The real-time railroad system is 5G, and the word enough is not even in the technocrat's dictionary. The Knight Foundation, which is the producer of this article, is fishing for more innovative ideas on how to collect and use data in the smart home and smart city. The problem, of course, is that no amount of data will ever result in wisdom, which is the greatest human need in the modern world. The story starts out on November 13, Knight Foundation. And by the way, Knight Foundation used to be a publishing company of some repute. It is not in the publishing industry anymore, but it now is a social do-gooder involved with sustainable development type things. And it says, Knight Foundation opened a new call for ideas exploring transformational ways data can be used to build stronger, thriving, and more engaged communities. Knight's Lillian Coral shares details below. See the press release here. It's listed. You can go to the link. Imagine at the main intersection near your home, seeing freshly painted crosswalks and new signals alerting vehicles, bicycles, and pedestrians of oncoming traffic. Last year, the neighborhood was concerned because of multiple accidents in the area. Impressed that the city has finally done something about this issue, you ask Siri to let your city council member know you support efforts to improve pedestrian safety. You get an alert on your phone thanking you for your feedback. And soon after, you see a Facebook notification about the planning department's virtual town hall meeting to reimagine the blighted corner down the street. Since you have ideas to add, you decide to participate. This vision relies on the power of open data. That intersection was identified based on collision and injury data. Signals collect data about riders and usage patterns. Resident feedback can be collected from different platforms or services, public or private. That feedback then needs to be shared as points of data with the planning department or through applications connected to Siri. Siri, by the way, is the virtual assistant that Apple invented and uses on all of us Apple devices now. The article continues, when digital services like our phones make our lives easier, they do that through the robust, seamless exchange of data. Much of that data is harnessed to improve commercial services, our food orders, ride shares, and the social media sites where we connect with family and friends. But this is just the tip of the iceberg. The power of data, especially open data, made available by government and, in some cases, private companies, also extends to the possibility of better informing and engaging residents, encouraging them to participate in more critically focused activities. It is in this context that Knight Foundation is issuing an open call for ideas that advance the concept of open data and civic engagement to encourage a new set of transformative approaches for using, understanding, and taking action with public data. Selected recipients can earn a share of up to $1 million in funding for their ideas and projects. If we meet people in digital spaces, can we advance new approaches for sharing, displaying, interpreting, and communicating with data? What are some alternative ways to collect and analyze data to inform smarter, more collaborative decisions? What are the user-friendly ways to serve, empower, and engage residents and help them build stronger, more thriving communities? The idea of public access to open data is not new. In addition to government, more private enterprises are actively publishing open data. For example, Uber Movement's open data portal provides anonymized data from more than 2 billion Uber trips for non-commercial reuse. This volume of data, while technically open, is not actually accessible to non-technical experts. Many residents are not citizen scientists, and efforts to train them to become more data savvy are slow and force them to earn the right to engage civically in a digital age. Well, you can read the rest of this story. The idea that I get out of it, you'll have the digital haves and have-nots. If you're not data savvy, you can't play. If you are, it's a wonderful thing. I'm going to play for you, however, a short one-minute video from a 2017 report on global cities. This is the type of scenario that will result by collecting data. You can never get enough data. Technocrats crave and lust after data. But listen to the short video. Of course, you can't see it. You can go to the website, technocracy.news, and read this article, and you can play the movie there and see the video as well. But it is interesting just to hear the video by itself. So here we go.
I am alive. Vibrant with possibility. A magnet for young creative talent. The engine for a knowledge economy. A river runs through me. There are many tributaries to my capital flows. I am an urban regenerator, a startup incubator, a creator of new opportunities, the catalyst for technological innovation, a laboratory for creative ideas. I am ever evolving, fusing the ancient with the modern, a transforming digital infrastructure. My social network's as diverse as my population. I am a host to opportunity, a home to establishment, a seat of academic learning, a cultural hub, a tech city, a de-zoned, mixed-use melting pot of people and ideas. I am the future, a millennial possibility, a corporate HQ, a growing business idea, an Olympic destination, an investment opportunity. I am a global city.
Well, you get the idea pretty quickly that this is all about the millennials. This is a promise to the millennials to be plugged into the cities of the world. And even though not every city can be a global city, the concept is still the same. Let's have our little mini utopia right here in our own city and why all you people can be involved and it'll create great opportunities. The problem with this is, of course, that the last time I looked, the entire millennial generation is in shambles. They're up to their eyeballs in school debt. And even in places like Silicon Valley in California, you find millennials working for these big tech giants, living in their cars, parked somewhere on a street or even in the parking lot, some of the companies that let them do that. The millennials at this point have very little hope for their future. Of course, this needs to change, but it's not going to change by shoving more technocracy down their throat and promising them, well, all we need is just a little bit more data. If we had more data, life would be great. You'll see, utopia is just around the corner. Like I said yesterday, the promise of utopia is always just around the corner. It has been just around the corner for decades now, and it never arrives. And I got bad news for him. It won't ever arrive because it's not there. It's not real. It's a mirage. So read the story. You'll get some insight from it. Data, data everywhere, but not 1 ounce of wisdom. The next story comes from Forbes magazine, and I included this one because, well, it is from Forbes. Forbes is a major semi-globalist publication, And the title of the story is How the IoT, or Internet of Things, Enables Push-Button Regulation from a Distance. Well, that's exactly what we've been talking about for a long, long time here. Their take on it is interesting. I wrote at the top of this article, the Internet of Things is designed as a command and control system to regulate the entire system in which they operate, that is, those devices. And this includes humans contained therein as well. Now, the author of this article rightly concludes, and this is a quote, the smart cities movement potentially may present the most significant incarnation of regulation from a distance, though. Versions I've noticed seem to involve heavy governmental control partnered with large corporations or government-preferred players. And isn't that the truth? It's the semi-fascist merger of government with smart corporations who are impressing their will on local communities through those governments. So the Forbes article states, artificial intelligence can be curiously stupid. I agree with that, by the way. My Android phone still thinks I'm, quote, Wing Cruz and doesn't know my kids. Pandora overplays The Church and DEMA 5, no offense, he says. As hackable as Alexa, Jeep Cherokees, and credit card services are over a public internet not designed for security, the network gadgetries enabled by the Internet of Things continue to dazzle. An overwhelming number of them will be on display again in January at the 2020 Consumer Electronics Show. That takes place in Las Vegas, by the way. The primary vulnerability of the IoT is not hackers, though, but IoT policy, technology that overcomes market failure in the provision of goods and services, should enable the reduction and streamlining of regulatory burdens. Instead, it sometimes threatens to foster the expansion of government power. That is, the same IoT that animates objects can also mean instantaneous nanny state regulation from a distance of drones, vehicles, buildings, social media use, schooling, and more. You've heard of free-range kids versus helicopter parenting? Well, the society fancying itself on the verge of flying cars may face helicopter government instead. Assorted bureaucrats clicking and swiping from afar using the IoT to control the IoT. It's one thing for Tesla to send its own software updates to its customers' cars. We definitely want such things to happen. A lot, actually. And of course, with the trouble that Tesla has been having recently with bugs, yes, customers desperately want to have fixes to the bugs in their cars. It continues. But as Jason Dorier noted in Singularity Hub, regulations written into software could be highly appealing to regulators. No drones within 100 feet of federal buildings rule, for example, could be enforced by requiring the upload to network objects of software patches, altering GPS coordinates, and disabling them in the event of noncompliance. Dorier named other examples. Software patches imposing speed restrictions and no drive zones on vehicles, preventing cars from starting without seatbelt attachment, and mandating thermostat settings and water use restrictions in buildings. Entrepreneur Mark Andreessen long ago described software eating the world. Titans in sectors from movies to agriculture to national defense are now software companies run on software and delivered as online services. Unfortunately, when software has eaten business models, it is not eating traditional top-down central regulatory regimes in the sense of displacing them. Those systems are preparing to eat the IoT instead. The next step in this evolution could go beyond rules mandating the updating or patching of software to unelected bureaucrats simply doing it themselves remotely by clicking and swiping rather than enacting a law or rule, constitution notwithstanding. The use of guidance documents, informal directives, and other offers you can't refuse are already a prominent regulatory concern highlighted by the Administrative Conference of the United States. The IoT could magnify such abuse. And indeed it could. This is the same kind of warning that Technocracy News and Trends has been issuing now for several years that the up-and-coming Internet of Things is not really about making life more convenient, although it might in some cases, but is actually a command and control system designed to control not only the devices, but also the people attached to them. And it's coming fast. And the last bit of enablement necessary to make it happen is 5G. And the reason is, for the first time in history, 5G will provide real-time data transfers and updating. It is incredibly fast, so fast that many people just look at it and say, it's magic. Of course, we know it's not magic, but it is that fast. The last article has to do with a very concerning topic. The title is Populism Naturally Bonds with Technocracy in Italy. Now, this is a story in Italy that we've been following for at least 2 years now. The populist movement in Italy has been very much like in other countries, including the United States, Brazil, Chile, perhaps to some extent, other countries in Europe to some extent. And populism has been very successful, politically speaking. Italy has long had a topsy-turvy political system, however. Not only has their economic condition gone up and down like a yo-yo over the years, but their political system as well. And now that the populists have more power in Italy than probably ever before, they're faced with a problem on how to run the country. The scary thing here is they're turning to technocracy to do it. And that's exactly what this story brings out. Very pointedly, I might add. My comments above the story, however, are Italy's populist movement continues to embrace technocracy to form a natural alliance called technopopulism. I want you to remember that word, please. Technopopulism. The first TN articles appeared in mid-2018, and now the globalist Financial Times has noticed, and this article is from the Financial Times. That's one of the most prestigious globalist publications in the world. Technopopulism is the most dangerous trend in modern society because populists generally reject globalization, but then turn to technocracy to run their broken societies, not realizing that technocracy is the ultimate expression of globalization. So check out this article. Italy's new coalition government, composed of the Five Star Movement and the Democratic Party, has been praised internationally in a plethora of unlikely plaudits from Jean-Claude Juncker, the outgoing European Commission president, and U.S. President Donald Trump, all the way to the Vatican. This alliance of former sworn enemies cannot be explained simply as an effort to keep Matteo Salvini's far-right National League out of power. Rather, Italy's new political experiment also represents a synthesis of the two main forces that have defined European politics over the past decade, populism and technocracy. I want you to note here, by the way, the easy use of the word technocracy in the Financial Times article. They have made no effort to hide the fact that technocracy is the major method of governance within the European Union. So here, in any case, they express that populism and technocracy appear to be a problem. The Five Star Movement is a populist party. It first rose to prominence through its founder and charismatic leader, Beppe Grillo's vehement denunciations of political elites. They call that La Casta in Italian, and remains committed to a bottom-up form of direct democracy, which sidelines the role of parliament and intermediary institutions. Yet, the party is now calling for a, quote, responsible government to avoid a confrontation with the EU over the upcoming budget. Mr. Grillo even suggested that the governing team should be made up of independent technicians, or technocrats, though in the end, only a few key ministers were not assigned to explicitly partisan officials. The PD has historically been the party of institutional propriety and stability. It sided with the country's judicial system in its struggles against former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi and was one of the main supporters of Mario Monti's technocratic government after the 2011 economic crisis. Yet, it is now calling for a radical turn in the way the country is run, and has proposed a new executive he labeled the, quote, government of novelty. What is taking shape in Italy is a paradoxical crossbreed of populism and technocracy, or technopopulism. Now remember, we're reading from a major globalist economic publication here. They're calling this curious paradoxical crossbreed of populism and technocracy as the main issue here. It marries an anti-establishment appeal and calls for radical political change with claims to institutional responsibility and fiscal competence designed to reassure international partners and global investors. What holds them together is what they both stand against. This is a paradox, if not an oxymoron. Far from being at odds with each other, populism and technocracy are actually two sides of the same coin. As political scientist Jan Werner Müller has pointed out, populism hold that there is only one authentic will of the people, whereas technocracy holds that there is only one correct policy solution. They therefore share a deeply anti-political strain. Each claims to possess some kind of truth, which makes parliamentary politics redundant and leads them to see opponents as enemies. It is no coincidence that both Mr. Grillo and former PD Prime Minister Matteo Renzi have described Mr. Salvini as a barbarian. Yet, Five Star is just coming out of a coalition with the League, and Mr. Renzi's government once relied on votes from the center-right to keep dangerous Five Star movement out of power. In a system in which populism and technocracy are the only options on offer, every government is bound to present itself as a way of staving off a catastrophe, since the opposite of the one authentic will of the people, or the, quote, one correct policy solution, must be either political error or malice. So the Financial Times has hit the nail on the head with technopopulism. It is a very curious combination of political power. But there have been other countries as well where the populist movement has grabbed onto technocracy to help it run the country. I believe we're seeing this happen to some extent in the United States right now. And although there's many things that President Trump has done that might be socially appealing to some, on the other hand, he was the one that called for the breakneck speed race to beat China to implement 5G in our country. He's also spent billions of dollars on other types of high-tech improvement in America that falls more into the hands of technocrats than it does to the people of the country. But as Americans and Italians demand more autonomy and more will of the people, they will increasingly be turning to technocracy to help them manage the system, because just being a populist doesn't mean that you can run the complex systems of government. You must appoint experts. And those experts, if nothing else, give credibility to the rest of the world that you actually know what you're doing. And this is the case in Italy's part. If they didn't have these people in charge of these vital functions, well, people would look in at Italy and say, what are they doing over there? Their country's going to implode and just fall apart. Well, nobody's going to invest money in that. So we find that they're thrown together into the same bedroom, and they're merging, and they seem to be getting along just fine. On the other hand, they both hate each other. Well, sometimes that's the way the world goes. I'm Patrick Wood for Technocracy News and Trends. We'll see you next time.